Good evening. My name is Navjeet KC, and I'm Student Project Manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, it is my pleasure to welcome you to tonight's program, The Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, Two States or One. The conflict between Israel and Palestine has been a central issue in world politics since the middle of the 20th century. Numerous attempts have been made to find a solution to the conflict, but clashes in the region have continued to recur. The Israeli invasions of Lebanon in 2006 and the Gaza Strip in 2008 serve as the latest examples of violence. Speaking to us on this subject will be former Ambassador Philip C. Wilcox, Jr., President of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, a Washington, D.C.-based foundation devoted to fostering peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Ambassador Wilcox served for the U.S. Foreign Service for 31 years before retiring in 1997. His last overseas assignment was as Chief of Mission and U.S. Consul General in Jerusalem. Ambassador Wilcox is also a recipient of a number of awards, including the Distinguished Service Award from Americans for Peace Now. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. Now, please join me in welcoming Ambassador Philip Wilcox.
Thank you very much, President Durden, and students and faculty, and the leadership of the Clark Forum. It's great to be back at Dickinson. I was here 4 years ago, and when I was invited to come back, I jumped at the chance. And when I asked my wife, Cinda, if she wanted to come with me, she said, of course I do. So I was delighted to be here at this great American liberal arts college. When I tell people that I'm the president of a group called the Foundation for Middle East Peace, they roll their eyes and they say, if there was ever an oxymoron, it's Middle East peace. Indeed, that's the view that many Americans have about this conflict, that it's one of these primordial religious tribal conflicts that will never be resolved. And alas, it has festered now for almost 100 years, and there is no immediate solution in sight. It reminds me a bit of the story of the young Jewish boy in Poland 100 years ago who finished school, and his parents said, now you go out there, Moshe, and get a job. And he spent 6 months on his job search. And he came back empty-handed every day. And finally, he came home with a big smile on his face, and he said, Mom, I've got a job. And his mother said, well, Moshe, that's wonderful. Are you going to be a doctor or a lawyer? And he said, no, I'm going to sit at the synagogue. The rabbi has hired me to sit at the synagogue and wait for the Messiah. And his mother said, well, that sounds like a terrible job. I bet the pay is lousy. And he said, yeah, the pay is lousy, Mom, but the job security is great. It seems, alas, that we're still waiting for the Messiah. As we watch this conflict deepen, as we watch frequent American, international, Israeli, and Arab efforts fail, and we are inclined to surrender to despair. Alas, the Israelis, the Palestinians, for the most part, have done so. They've virtually given up hope that this generations-old conflict can be resolved. But we can't do that. We can't sink into despair. This is a matter not only of helping our friends in Israel and Palestine. It's a matter of helping ourselves, because this is a premier American national security issue. Our safety and security are at stake, as well as theirs. This is a conflict that has inflamed anger, extremism. It has provoked terrorism against Americans and the West, not to mention the people of the region. This is a conflict because of our inability to resolve it, has weakened the goodwill toward America and the region, our credibility as a nation. It is a conflict which has taken on a dangerous and even more dangerous new dimension with the potential for nuclear arms in Iran, pitted against a nuclear-armed state of Israel. The specter of nuclear warfare in the Middle East is terrifying. So this is an urgent issue, and we should not waste our time saying it's impossible, there's nothing we can do about it. We need to try much harder to resolve this in our own interest, above all. There is some understanding now that there is, at least in theory, a way out of this historic conflict, and that is to divide the land of historic Palestine, into two states. The state of Israel in the white area here, which represented the state of Israel before, between 1948 and 1967, and a state of Palestine in what are now called the occupied territories, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Arab East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, which is no longer occupied, but it is still under virtual Israeli control. The formula for peace, and this is now well known, is a division of the land into two states with two capitals in the holy city of Jerusalem. Well, we and they have utterly failed to get there, notwithstanding the understanding that this is almost certainly the only way out. Why is that? And why have the Israelis and the Palestinians almost given up in despair? Why has this been such an intractable conflict, the longest-lasting regional conflict, perhaps, of our century? There are lots of reasons. There is a kind of perverse negative psychology which has crippled both of the parties, the Israelis and the Palestinians. I'll talk more about it later. Both of them have this sense of exclusive victimization. Both of them have failed to reach out and understand the rights, the equities, the suffering of the other. Perhaps above all, the factor that has thwarted peace is the massive settlement of Israeli citizens in the West Bank. Today there are some 500,000 Israeli settlers living in what is known as occupied territory. Reversing this process will be a massive task, but unless that happens, it is very hard to foresee a division of the land into two states. There is the chronic internal disunity in both of these societies and dysfunctional politics that have made it difficult, if not impossible, for them thus far to work out a successful compromise, a land for peace a solution. Both sides suffer from this dysfunctionality in internal ideological, political, and religious division. Then there has been weak and confused, ineffectual international policy and American policy over the years, and yes, a bias in favor of one side, the state of Israel, for many reasons, historical and other, which I'll discuss. There has also been a foolish obsession with violence as a political weapon, both by the Israelis and by the Palestinians. The folly that somehow they could persuade their enemies to back down, to weaken, to compromise, or to surrender under the force of violence. And the bloodletting we saw in Gaza just 2 months ago was an example of this resort to force. The bloodletting and the Qassem rocket fire by the Palestinians that provoked this massive Israeli invasion. Now there is an even deeper crisis because the new government of Israel is a right-wing government, a hawkish government, which rejects the idea of two states, which rejects the idea of withdrawing from Israeli settlements, and which believes that ultimately with sufficient force and will, the Palestinians will surrender and the state of Israel will be greater Israel, including not only Israel from 48 to 67, but all of the territories occupied thereafter. Well, President Obama has said, I'm going to work for peace from the day one. And many of us were encouraged when he appointed Senator George Mitchell as his Middle East envoy. There's no more able, committed, talented diplomat than George Mitchell, so that's a very good sign. Still, people say the Obama administration is whistling in the dark. It's just too hard to do. Indeed, as worthy a diplomat as Aaron David Miller, who was the deputy American negotiator during the 1990s, said, there's no deal there, and the United States should not undermine, weaken its credibility, and fall on its sword in trying to make a deal where no deal exists. This is the argument of ripeness, that we should wait until the stars are aligned, until there is a real potential for peace. I've heard that for decades now, and I've watched the situation grow worse and worse. It will never ripen into a situation where peace can be easily made. As long as it's neglected, the worse it gets. And to wait in the vain hope it's going to get better is only to confront an even more intractable problem later on. Well, let me talk a little bit in greater detail about some of the elements which have thwarted peace and divided these two parties. All nations are the product of their histories. All nations, particularly young nations, develop national mythologies, patriotic narratives. Some have been better able than others to face the reality of their circumstances and to deal pragmatically with them and to thrive. Not all ancient ethnic and religious conflicts are intractable. The British and the French fought for generations, centuries. They are friends and allies now. Northern Ireland was torn by conflict for many generations. They are now at peace. Peace can be made even among the deepest adversaries. The weight of history can be overcome. The weight of ultra-nationalism, national mythologies, can be overcome. And that must happen if there's to be peace between Israel and Palestine. Zionism, as you know, was a product of Western anti-Semitism, Christian anti-Semitism. It was the result of the failure of the Jewish people to win acceptance and equality in Western Christian society. And so they sought to seek refuge in a Jewish homeland, a new Jewish homeland, in their ancient homeland of Palestine. They said this will create a normal state, a refuge where the Jews, where we can live as normal people. Well, the State of Israel for some decades was a stunning success and enjoyed the goodwill and support of the rest of the world. But Israel is not a normal state. It is still in deep conflict with its closest neighbor, the Palestinian Arabs. It is probably the most dangerous place in the world for Jews to live. It has not succeeded in achieving normality and peace with its neighbors. The major reason for that is its inability to reckon with its closest neighbor, the Palestinian Arabs. The Palestinians have also a deep and passionate claim to their homeland, which happens to be the Jewish homeland as well. And this struggle has been the competition between two national movements to find a way to share the same land, to compromise, and to live side by side. They have failed utterly to do that. The Israeli experiment in settlement, which began in 1967, after the massive victory of the Israeli Defense Forces against combined Arab armies, at which time Israel occupied and conquered the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the Syrian Golan Heights, as well as the Sinai Desert, was a fateful turning point in Israeli history. There was an argument among Israelis about what to do. The liberals, the intellectuals, And many of the diplomats said it would be a terrible mistake for Israel to permanently occupy all of these Arab peoples, to turn them into a subject people. That will create constant warfare, bloodshed, and hatred. It will corrupt Israel as a Jewish democratic state. But those groups lost the argument. The Israeli armed forces, which liked the idea of more land, joined forces with a group of Messianic Jews whose unorthodox religious theology taught that the highest duty of the Jewish people was to reclaim all of the land that God gave to Abraham at any cost. And the land was more important than traditional Jewish values of justice, respect, and accommodation with other people. They won the battle, and since then, the settlement movement has grown to a monstrous proportion. Today there are 500,000 settlers. There are 200,000 in East Jerusalem and some 300,000 in the West Bank. Unless that movement is reversed, it will be impossible to divide the land. The notion of the settlers, the doctrine of the settlers, taught them that if the Jews can reclaim the ancient Jewish heartland of the West Bank, this will bring forth the Jewish Messiah. Very, very powerful and very dangerous doctrine, and Israel is now paying a heavy price for this national project, which it has pursued for the last 40 years. Well, turning to the psychology, the pathology, which has hurt both sides, their inability to look beyond their own fears, their own tragic histories, to try to understand the suffering and the tragedy of the other. This is a problem which will require not just the skills of diplomats and political scientists. It's a problem that has to address the psychological state of these two suffering societies. Both of them have tended to demonize the other. Both of them have ascribed all right and justice to themselves. Both of us, alas, have tended to dehumanize the other as a justification for doing terrible violence to them. And this victimization syndrome has been deeply, deeply crippling. Unfortunately, that has, just as it has bred polarization between Israelis and Palestinians, the same kind of polarization has affected the way that Americans look at this conflict, making it more difficult for us to look at it more objectively and realistically. The Palestinians, as a kind of mirror image, suffer the same kind of pathology, not recognizing that they are not the exclusive victims. To be sure, they lost their homeland. They were driven out of Israel, some 750,000 in 1948, turned into a nation of refugees. This is what has preoccupied them. Obviously it would, but they have had little understanding of the history of the Jewish people, which brought about Zionism. And they have tended to belittle it, and not to realize that it is a powerful force that they had to reckon with. Well, this tragedy, these two tragedies, have to be understood, and alas, they haven't been. Our view of the conflict has been colored by our history as a predominantly Christian nation, with a Judeo-Christian culture. We have been drawn to Israel and the Jewish people because of the Bible, the myths, the stories of the Holy Land, the common cultural, emotional, and religious bonds that link Americans to Israel. That's been a powerful, powerful factor. And it has, alas, made us take sides because we have no comparable understanding history for the Arab and Muslim people. And we have tended to view them with some hostility and suspicion
and fear. And even today, there is a strain of Islamophobia in American society. It was the Nazi era and the Holocaust, perhaps more than any other factor, that created this national, this alliance between Israel and the United States, a sense of guilt, of remorse for what happened to the Jewish people throughout history, and culminating in the horrors of the Nazi era and the Holocaust. We have not been as mindful, as heedful, or as understanding of the tragedy that the Palestinians suffered. So let's not take sides. Let's take sides with both of these people. They are all God's children. They deserve our compassion, our empathy, and support, and we have not provided it in equal measure. Well, the problem of internal disunity in both societies, the Israeli parliamentary system was skewed from the very beginning because of the demands of the religious parties who demanded a greater share of political power, ministries, seats in the Knesset than their demographic weight justified. David Ben-Gurion, the George Washington of Israel, decided to capitulate to them for fear that they would not support the state. Indeed, they had threatened to go to the United Nations in 1948 to lobby against the state if Ben-Gurion didn't bow to their demands. And this has produced a Knesset which is paralyzed by the power of small splinter religious and ideological right-wing parties who band together and have always done so to prevent decisive action by the leadership on issues of security and territory. And this blocking group supports the settlement movement. It opposes compromise with the Palestinians, and it has paralyzed effective Israeli diplomacy and policy when it comes to security and territory, their relations with the Arabs. The Palestinians suffer a similar division in their society between the fanatics, the extremists, who for the most part are Islamists, who believe that Allah gave all of the land of Palestine to the Muslim people, there is no presence, no right, no role for the Jewish people there. And they have opposed the state of Israel from the very beginning. The Islamic element in Palestinian politics was not strong in the beginning, but it has emerged as a dynamic, perhaps the most dynamic element in recent years. As the Hamas party has emerged, the Hamas quarreled and clashed with the Fatah. They decided to compete for the first time in democratic elections in 2006. To everyone's surprise, they won. The United States supported those elections as part of our new Middle East pro-democracy policy in the region. Yet when the wrong party won, we turned against our own policy, rejected Hamas, imposed sanctions against them, and said we will never deal with a Palestinian government which is led by Hamas. Indeed, when the Palestinians created a national unity government between the Fatah pragmatists of Yasser Arafat, who had by then died, and the Hamas, we still rejected that coalition government, and we decided to impose sanctions on Hamas. The result was an internal conflict, which we had helped foment between Hamas and Fatah, which resulted in a military clash in Gaza in which Hamas won. Today, there are two Palestinian governments. There's one in Gaza run by Hamas. There's another one in the West Bank, which is hardly a government. It's more of a ward of the Israeli Defense Forces, which occupy the West Bank in order to protect the settlers there. And this disunity has paralyzed the Palestinians. There will be no peace, there will be no real negotiations or understanding until the Palestinians are reunited. And the U.S. must change its futile policy of trying to eliminate one of the principal Palestinian political parties. Another problem in this conflict, as I mentioned, is that the playing field has never been equal.
from the very beginning, Israel had a powerful foreign patron. In the beginning, it was the United Kingdom, which
first endorsed and promoted the Zionist project with the Balfour Declaration. The British supported the idea of a Jewish home in Palestine as a strategic anchor that would support Britain's thrust into the Arab, into the Ottoman Empire. The British succeeded. They conquered the Ottoman Empire in World War I. They occupied Palestine and became the League of Nations mandatory power there. And they fostered a small but very successful young kind of proto-Jewish state in Palestine. That state would not have prospered because there were simply not enough Jews in a vastly larger Arab community. But the project became a vital one, indeed, for many Jews, a matter of survival as the Hitler era and the Holocaust emerged. The British threw up their hands and decided they couldn't resolve this. They tried everything, and they left. In the end, the British actually turned against Zionism and promoted a unitary binational state. But the newly formed British-trained Israeli army won in the War of 48, and the State of Israel was formed. Thereafter, it was the United States who became the supporter, tutelary protector of Israel. So throughout the history of this conflict, there's been a very, very strong international foreign support for Israel with no comparable support for the Palestinians. The Arabs purported to support the Palestinians. They did so with lip service, but it was never a close relationship. Indeed, the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, was created by the Arabs as an effort to manipulate and control the Palestinians. So the lack of attention, a lack of support for both sides in this by the international community has made it much more difficult to make peace. The settlement movement has grown worse over the years. Let me show you some photographs of some maps of how it developed after 67. You can see the little triangles which were placed in strategic locations all over the West Bank, earlier in Gaza, although they've been removed from Gaza, in an effort to create an irreversible situation, facts on the ground, as they called them. Later, in the early 2000s, the government of Ariel Sharon, after a terrible spasm of violence in the Second Intifada, built this black line here, the security barrier, as the Israelis call it, or the apartheid wall, as the Palestinians call it, in an effort to staunch terrorist infiltration, but also to create a new de facto border which would incorporate these very thick, intense Israeli settlements. In doing so, it created a truncated, non-viable Palestinian landmass that, in the interest of preserving the settlements, would prevent the emergence of a viable and contiguous Palestinian state. And that is the that's the lay of the land today. There are also a network of Israeli roads designed for the settlers. The red roads are for Palestinians. The white roads are for Israelis. The Palestinians exist in a series of enclaves or cantons surrounded by Israeli settlements, Israeli roads, and Israeli soldiers. This is not a viable formula for coexistence in the future. It's a formula for continued communal ethnic violence between Jews and Palestinians. And it must be reversed if there is to be peace. The problem is how in the world can up to 300,000 settlers be sent back home to Israel. Isn't this impossible? Many Israelis think it is.
They are frightened, much as they realize that the settlement adventure was a mistake, and majorities of Israelis, according to polls, think it was. They fear that there will be civil war if the Israeli Defense Forces attempt to remove all of these settlers. That is a real threat, because some of the settlers, perhaps 20%, are armed. They are fanatics. They believe they are servants of God in settling the land and staying there. And they've threatened to use force if there's an effort to dislodge them.
80% of the settlers, however, are normal secular Israelis. They went there because of lavish economic benefits, free mortgages, no down payments, and income tax advantages. And they have said, according to public opinion polls, that they would leave if they were compensated for their homes in exchange for a real and lasting and credible peace. So that's the nature of the challenge. That must be confronted. It never has been confronted. And even as the crisis deepens, the settlement population grows in the West Bank every week. The United States, throughout this period, has pursued a policy of what we call conflict management. And we have assumed, I think unwisely, that somehow the Israelis and the Palestinians can do this by themselves. It's very clear now that they can't. That the idea of a bilateral negotiating process in which they work it all out simply won't happen. The disparity of power between the two sides is huge. Israel occupies most of Palestinian territory. This cries out for strong, decisive, patient, and sustained international intervention and mediation. Conflict management, confidence building, step-by-step measures have all failed in the past. They will fail again. What is needed is an American policy. We have no real policy on settlements. We don't like them, but we have never defined which settlements should stay, which should go. We have never, except for a very brief period, at the end of the Clinton administration at the Camp David summit, described what our policy is on Jerusalem. We need a comprehensive American peace plan. That plan need not be invented, because Israelis and Palestinians themselves over the years, through informal and formal talks, have come up with solutions to all of these problems of settlements, borders, Jerusalem, water. Many of the settlements are built near the prime water resources of the West Bank. And the big problem of refugees. The Palestinians say they want to exercise the internationally protected right of return. And they say they or their grandchildren, children and grandchildren, should have a right to go back to Israel, to the lands and homes they lost in 1948 or in 1967, where people were expelled from the West Bank. The right of return cannot be exercised if there is to be peace. If it were exercised, it would threaten to dilute the Jewish majority in Israel, and it would possibly bring forth the end of the Zionist state. No Israeli, even the most dovish, would accept the right of return. It can only be accomplished symbolically with compensation rather than the actual return of Palestinians to their former homes in Israel. So this is the nature of the challenge, and what it means is transforming the policies and politics of Israel and Palestine. How in the world can we do that? I don't know that we can.
Indeed, many people say it is presumptuous for the U.S. To assume that it could somehow play this role, that we lack the power, the moral authority to do that. Well, if that's the case, then I think we're facing a hopeless impasse. Some people are beginning to say, well, let's have one state in which everyone has the right to vote. That's the Western democratic way. If there is one state, within perhaps 10 years or less, the majority of the voters, the citizens of one state, would be Palestinian Arabs.
They would use their franchise to create not a continuation of the Zionist state, but the end of the Zionist state. We recognize the weight, the power, and the history that led to the struggle for Zionism and the Jewish state. So a one-state solution is not a solution at all. It's a recipe for continued protracted conflict. Indeed, you could argue that there is a kind of de facto one state today, and it's a terrible mess. Well, how would a U.S. peace plan change this impasse? I don't know that it could, but if we were to reach out with a compassionate, well-defined peace plan which addressed the fundamental interests of both peoples, I think it could change the politics in those two societies. If they were offered hope in change in exchange for despair, if they were offered real freedom and real security, it's just possible that majorities in both societies would rally to this American initiative and support it. And if their leaders said, no, we're not going to compromise, we're not going to do that, they would find ways to choose new leaders. I see no other way to do that. I don't suggest that we can bludgeon the Israelis and the Palestinians in making peace to impose peace. We can't do it. Only they can do it, but they will not do it unless they see that it's a real possibility. They will not believe that there is such a possibility unless the United States and the international community puts their full weight behind it, stays with it, and believe me, it will take several years, provides the resources and the support that it would take. Fortunately, the Arab states are well prepared for this because they have abandoned their doctrine of rejecting Israel in the Arab League Declaration of 2002. Recently reaffirmed, the Arab states said, we're ready to give up our struggle against Israel. We're ready to make peace and have normal relations if Israel eliminates the Palestinian people. Well, the Israeli public, while conceptually understands that two states are necessary, they don't believe it's possible, and they're afraid. They say, well, the Gazans started shooting rockets at us when we liberated Gaza. And if we abandon the West Bank, they will use it as a staging area for making war against Israel, because the Palestinians don't want just a state in the West Bank, in Gaza and East Jerusalem. They still want to destroy Israel. Many Israelis believe that. They have told by their leaders that the violence and the terrorism of the Palestinians is a symptom of hatred and a desire to destroy Israel. Many of them don't believe or don't understand that the violence is the kind of rebellion and violence that usually occurs when one people for a long period of time is oppressed, deprived of its freedom and its just rights by another party. Well, this is an ambitious, perhaps a visionary formula for peace, but I see no other way to do it. I think the stakes are enormous for the state of Israel, because if Israel continues on this course, it will lose its democratic Jewish character. It will be increasingly militarized. It will have to rely more and more heavily on force and repression to maintain its security. Even now, Israel is losing its support and friendship of other countries in the world as they sink deeper into the mire of this settlement process. So Israel's future is threatened, deeply threatened. The future of the Palestinians, who aspire to be normal people living in freedom and sovereignty in a state of their own, will be defeated. And both Israelis and Palestinians will be increasingly brutalized by force and this ugly confrontation. So a lot here is at stake. A lot is at stake for the United States in terms of our own national security. So let's hope that the Obama administration is true to its word, that it will take this on amidst its other massive problems. Public opinion polls in Israel and Palestine show that both people would like to have two states if it were only possible. Public opinion polls in the United States repeatedly show that the majority of Americans want stronger American diplomatic leadership. No less important, polls show that the majority of Jewish Americans want stronger American leadership. There is a powerful myth that our government is hostage to what is called the, quote, Jewish lobby, unquote. That is a myth. The President of the United States makes our policies, not a Jewish lobby. Moreover, there are many Jewish lobbies in this country. There is a growing group of progressive Jewish lobbies of American Jews who are loyal Zionists, faithful to Israel, and wanted to succeed and thrive, but who dislike Israeli policy, recognize that it's very dangerous for Israel and very dangerous for the United States. This is a hopeful sign. President Obama, if he chose to, could build a peace coalition of American Jews, Christians, Muslims, Arab Americans as his peace constituency, and no right-wing Israeli lobby which sees its role as supporting Israeli government policy, right or wrong, could defeat that. This will take imagination, patience, and courage, but it can be done. It will be more easily done, of course, if all of us as American citizens add our voices in support of peace and encourage this change of policy by the United States. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer your questions or hear your comments. Yes, ma'am. The lady in the orange shirt.
Hi. I'm just wondering what you think should be done about Gilad Shalit.
About?
Gilad Shalit on this his 1,000th day in captivity.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question. Could you repeat it?
I'm just curious what you think should be done about Gilad Shalit.
What should be done about the...
Gilad Shalit.
Gilad Shalit. I think he should be released by Hamas. I think there needs to be a prisoner exchange. That is possible. There have been prisoner exchanges in the past. There are thousands of Palestinian prisoners being held by Israel, including a great many politicians who are not involved in acts of terrorism or violence. I think there needs to be a prisoner exchange. The government of Egypt is attempting to serve as a go-between to negotiate that. It hasn't happened yet, but it should happen as a step toward an end of this confrontation between Gaza and Israel. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I noticed in your map of the peace plan that the Golan Heights goes back to Syria.
Yes.
Do you think it's necessary for peace that this small piece of land that was clearly strategic and used by a regime that's clearly anti-Semitic and historically shown that Syrian troops have used this position during times of peace to fire pot shots against kibbutzim that's next to the border? Do you still feel that it's necessary that the Golan go back to Syria, that the peace can exist with Golan remaining in Israeli hands?
The Golan Heights may have been of some strategic value to the State of Israel in 1967 when it was conquered by Israeli forces. Today, high-speed missiles and high-speed aircraft can function without small pieces of land as a buffer between two adversary states. The so-called strategic objectives are advantages are a thing of the past. The strategy for Israel and for Syria should be to make peace. That is a way they can protect their security. Indeed, there's a growing interest in both Israel and Syria in making peace, and even right-wing Israeli governments have expressed an interest in abandoning the Golan Heights, and in the process using that peacemaking to turn Syria away from support for Hamas and support for the Hezbollah in Lebanon. The United States under the Bush administration did not support that process because we disliked the government of Syria. We regarded it as part of the axis of evil, and we wished somehow that it would go away and thought by not talking to them that it would go away.
The Obama administration has already expressed an interest in supporting an Israeli-Syrian peace process, which would deal both with the Hamas and Hezbollah problems, but which would also return the Golan Heights to Syria. Yes, sir.
You've spoken about the Israeli leadership, but you haven't said much about leadership among the Palestinians. So I really wanted to ask a question in two parts. How do you interpret the failure of Yasser Arafat, or the refusal of Yasser Arafat, to agree to the Camp David Accords when it was reported, at least widely in the press, that he had already agreed to 95% of what he had wanted? And then the other part of my question is, given the fact that you have Hamas in Gaza, which is an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood, which certain Arab states would not be happy to see get the upper hand, in the post-Arafat Palestinian world, where you have Hamas and Fatah, which is also very corrupt or has been very corrupt, what future do you see for an emerging Palestinian leadership?
The Palestinians have had largely lousy leadership over the years. It's been a curse. I do give Yasser Arafat credit when he turned the Palestinian National Movement away from rejection and toward accommodation and a two-state peace with Israel in 1998. I think he was serious about it, and he worked hard on it for some years. He's a lousy negotiator. He blew it at the Camp David summit by simply walking away. But there's no real consensus on what happened at Camp David. Many writers, the majority of them Israelis, have said that the narrative of the Israeli government and of the United States after Camp David, that it was the Palestinians who rejected a generous offer and walked away from peace because they didn't want peace, they wanted war and the destruction of Israel, is simply bunk. That the offer that was made was indeed generous by Israeli standards, but it didn't go nearly far enough to satisfy genuine Palestinian needs. It would have preserved large enclaves of Israeli settlements. It would have maintained Israeli control over access to the aquifer, water aquifer that supports both states. It would not have created an equitable and sustainable resolution of the Jerusalem issue. So there's a lot of mythology on both sides about Camp David, and I would be wary of accepting the patriotic one-sided narrative of one side or the other. The Hamas leadership is divided between the Islamists, the radicals, and a more pragmatic group within Hamas. The Fatah leadership hardly exists any longer, and the secular Fatah movement is in decline. And this will make it far more difficult for peace to be made. The Israeli leadership is also lacking in vision, and the new leadership will be a radical right leadership which does not want peace or compromise. I think the only way to encourage the emergence of wiser leaders in Israel and Palestine is to offer the people in those countries an opportunity to escape this tragic mess and to re-enliven politics in both countries with a strong American support and international intervention. That, in turn, I think will transform the politics of the two countries and the people buoyed, encouraged by the prospect of getting out of this mess will demand better and wiser leadership, and that radical, intransigent rejectionist leaders will ultimately be pushed aside. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, the recent war in Gaza, the 23 days, that showered Gaza children and the women and the elderly with cluster bombs. What is the position of the United States that Israel was accused of war crimes? We've seen it live on television. It was never aired on American television, not on CNN, NBC, ABC. We've seen it on Democracy Now. I've seen it on Al Jazeera live. The children were killed with cluster bomb. The women, the children, the parents, everybody was killed. What is the position of the United States?
I regret that during the war, the United States did not immediately demand a ceasefire, that we did not put the highest value on human life. Instead, we said, just as our government said during the war between Israel and the Hezbollah in 2006, that we want a lasting, sustainable ceasefire. That was the wrong policy. If we had stood up earlier, joined with the international community to stop this war, it would have stopped. We didn't do that because we wanted to see the Israeli Defense Forces crush Hamas and weaken them so that they would no longer be in the leadership in Gaza. That was a stupid policy. And the price was paid by, as you say, hundreds and hundreds of innocent civilians. Using modern weapons, bombers, tanks, high explosives in a densely populated urban area, however careful the military forces are, is wrong. It doesn't work. It does not achieve peace. It only deepens hatreds, and it kills human beings. So I think the Gaza war was a terrible mistake. It was the response of a Israeli public that was deeply worried and afraid of the barrage of Qassam rockets against Israeli towns and villages. And the Israeli politicians succumbed to this public panic and fear by saying, we're going to destroy Hamas, we're going to make a war. They didn't destroy Hamas. They made war, but the conflict is deeper than ever. There was an alternative to making war, and that was to negotiate on an opening of the closure around Gaza. And the Hamas leadership said, if the closure is lifted, we will stop the Qassam rockets. That didn't happen.
I was just wondering, after your comment, how do you expect the United States to help the state where it has obviously policy biases?
Where it has obviously what?
Policy biases.
Policy biases. I think we can be of tremendous help. I think we can use our historic alliance with Israel much more wisely than we have in the past. Real friends treat their friends with candor and honesty. And when their friends are pursuing policies which are harmful to themselves and to us, they tell them so. That has not been the nature of our relationship with Israel. We have more or less offered them a blank check. That's not the way you treat friends. I think the American-Israeli alliance is deep and lasting. I think we must use it more creatively, and I do not suggest that we abandon Israel, that we threaten it. I'm suggesting that we use it as friends ought to use friendships. I think we need to express the same kind of friendship toward the Palestinian people, too, who are the other party in the conflict and deserve our support and sympathy, just as our Israeli friends do. I think it's possible, and I think the American people would like to see this happen. Yes, ma'am.
My question is about the prospect for peace talks. Do you think that the new government in Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, do you think that he will sit down if Barack Obama says, I want to have peace talks? Do you think he's at the point where he will sit down and have peace talks? Or do you think that Obama will need to put more pressure on him, perhaps withhold U.S. aid or U.S. arms and force him to sit down? How do you think this can proceed from here?
I wouldn't call it pressure. I'd call it friendly persuasion. I think the United States underestimates its influence, its ability to influence thinking and the politics in Israel and in Palestine. I think we could use it wisely, and I think they would respond. I think there would be a long period of tension, which we are unaccustomed to, and I think we would have to endure that, but without threatening the Israelis to begin speaking more candidly and honestly to them about their situation and ours and the Palestinians and what the future will bring if this situation isn't changed. They would listen to us. We would have to do it with real sensitivity, with real compassion, and we have the ability to do that, I think, particularly a president like Barack Obama. And I think George Mitchell is a superb diplomat. He negotiated for years with the Irish. He never called them terrorists. He listened and he listened, and then he counseled them. They developed confidence in him and the United States. They changed their policies. It'll take a long time, though.
This kind of goes along with the previous question. You mentioned the need to recognize Hamas, and I was wondering if you think that it's likely that the Obama administration will do that.
Not at the beginning. I think we will rely on intermediaries to communicate with Hamas, but the idea of boycotting important parties to political conflicts is a silly idea. For decades, we negotiated and we had very intensive contacts with the Soviet Union, even while it was vowing to destroy us. To impose conditions to negotiations or contacts is a mistake. The United States, Israel, the Europeans have said we will not have contacts with Hamas until it recognizes the state of Israel. Israel did not demand, nor did we, that Egypt recognize the state of Israel until Israel and Egypt made peace. Nor did we do so when Israel negotiated with the Kingdom of Jordan. This is silly. The conditions that have to be met by Hamas are conditions that indeed have to be met, but they won't be met until they do so in the context of negotiations. We're saying we cannot deal with a unity government which has a Hamas component, yet we are prepared, and I know we will deal with a Netanyahu government, one of whose constituent parties rejects any rights for the Palestinians, has rejected all past agreements that Israel and the Palestinians have made. It is the mirror image of rejectionism that Hamas presents to Israel. So I think we need to be a little more even-handed and balanced. The leader of the Israel Bitanu party, Avigdor Lieberman, who will probably be the foreign minister, has advocating bombing the Aswan Dam in Egypt. We're not saying that we'll never talk to him or that we won't talk to his government. So I think we need to think more clearly about our policy with respect to contacts with Hamas.
Time for one last question.
You've talked a lot about the role of the United States. It's curious to me that we feel that the United States has a preeminent role in determining what happens in the Middle East. There are lots of other countries and lots of other groups who have a lot of investment in the Middle East, the peoples of the Middle East, and peace in the Middle East. One of those groups is a group called the Elders, among which, as you know, former President Jimmy Carter is a member. How do you feel about their role, what they have said so far, and what their future role might be in achieving peace?
I think Jimmy Carter is one of the most influential American citizens who is involved informally and unofficially in the struggle for peace. He's just written another book, and I think he's deeply respected by both Americans. He's controversial as well. I would dearly hope that we could hand over this task to the European Union, to the United Nations, to the Arab states, to someone else, so that we could focus exclusively on our major problems here at home. We can't. There is no other single nation that has the experience, the relationships, most of all the relationship with Israel, that can do this job. We are fated to do it. Unless we do, no one else can. I'm sorry about that. That's the reality, I think. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
On behalf of Dickinson College and the Clark Forum, I would like to once again thank Ambassador Wilcox.